This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, calls for federal government to investigate NYPD killing of Romali Graham.
But now, analyzing the landmark decision holding stop and frisk unconstitutional with Samuel Walker, criminal justice expert and witness in the historic trial. Judge Scheindlin's decision confirms what the communities subject to being stopped and frisked already know. The NYPD stop and frisk program violates the constitutional rights of Black and Latino New Yorkers every day. Samuel Walker takes us through Judge Scheindlin's voluminous decision
to discuss what a monitor can do, what they've done in other states, and Judge Scheindlin's other recommendations, including in her decision, and still others that institutionalize the attack on racial profiling. We'll also discuss AG Eric Holder's comments on minimum sentencing and criminal justice reform.
Samuel Walker, welcome to Building Bridges.
Please call me Sam.
I will indeed.
Okay. Right.
And I want to start by a quote that's been blasted across the New York press by Mayor Bloomberg on hearing of the decision, which he has vowed to appeal despite the fact that he will soon be out of office. If somebody pulls a gun and you want to get home to your family, you don't have time to say, well, now, wait a second. The commissioner said one thing, the monitor said another, and the IG inspector yet another. Well, what's wrong with the statement of Mayor Bloomberg to begin with in the context of racial profiling and stop and frisk?
It is utterly irresponsible, just pure demagoguery. The scenario that he just described is not what was at issue in this case. On stops and frisks. It doesn't have people who are pulling a gun on somebody. It involves police officers saying that they have reasonable suspicion that somebody is committing or about to commit a crime and then conducting a stop and frisk. So it's a totally different situation. And the mayor has just been completely irresponsible, his response to this case.
Sam, the issues involved have to do with the constitutionality of stop and frisk. The mayor really talks about that it's an effective program, that it works, which just about everybody says it doesn't. But let's talk about the constitutionality of the stop and frisk practices of the NYPD. Why is it unconstitutional?
There was voluminous evidence that officers were conducting stops without reasonable suspicion. You know, you have to have reasonable suspicion that a person is committing or about to commit a crime. When you look at the reports that the officers are required to fill out, in something like 30% of the cases, that's not there. So when you take 30% of 4.4 million stops and frisks since 2004, I mean, you've just got hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers who are being stopped without legal justification.
Sam, we already know, as I said, certainly within the community, that we believe that Judge Scheindlin got it right, that the NYPD's practices violate New York's Fourth Amendment rights to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. And, of course, she also found that the practices were racially discriminatory in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. But where I want to go with this really is the community. I spoke to a number of youth and do it in the context, certainly, of my job as a legal aid attorney. And their perspective is there's no way that this is going to matter because, of course, we are profiled. Of course, we are singled out. That's the culture of policing. Within the context of this 198 page decision of Judge Scheindlin, is there anything that really gets to the heart of policing culture, which I certainly believe has an inherently discriminatory character to it?
Yes, there is. And you quoted the many people you've talked to who are very cynical about changing the police, and I understand that. And I've encountered that all across this country, but I'm optimistic. Are things in this decision, especially the appointment of the monitor, that I think can make a difference, and I think they will, because this time, unlike previous decisions, NYPD is ordered to make some changes in how it supervises and monitors its officers. There is an independent, court-appointed monitor there. That person is an officer of the court who can say, no, wait a minute, you're doing it wrong. You have to do it this way and not that way. And there are consequences. If NYPD officials are obstructionist and fail to implement the ordered reforms, they can be held in contempt. Really can make a difference. Over the long haul, having the right policies and having them enforced and changing the supervision can, in fact, change the activities of officers on the street. I believe it can happen.
There were a number of steps that the judge laid out, initially at least, to start to work on for the monitor and for the NYPD. Could you lay out some of those steps?
Well, it's really top to bottom, and that was my testimony in court, that we call it a comprehensive approach toward accountability. So at the ground level, out there in the street, officers are going to have a different form to fill out. When they conduct a stop and frisk, they're going to be held account. Do they have to articulate the reasonable suspicion? And there are going to be some changes in the supervision of what their sergeants do in terms of signing off or disapproving those stops and frisks. You get up to the mid-management level, there's going to be an audit procedure to see to it that in each of the precincts, they are in fact doing what they should be doing, what the court has ordered. So it's not going to happen overnight. There's going to be a lot of moaning and groaning and screaming, and the mayor and the commissioner have already started that, and the PBA has already started that too. But in other cities where similar reforms have been ordered, Los Angeles, Cincinnati, Washington, D.C., over the long haul, over the course of a couple of years, officers begin to comply with the law.
This really is a historic victory. The result is not only 14 years worth of litigation, but decades worth of efforts by activists and grassroots and legal organizations and effective communities. It is a definitive victory. And, of course, the appeal certainly has not yet been filed, but we are expecting that. But I want to just get a sense from you, going back earlier to the question of the culture of policing, what actually are some of the recommendations, the steps that have taken place in other venues across the country that have begun to at least identify and root out or rectify or discipline conscious or unconscious manifestations of racial profiling?
Well, there have been consent decrees in many cities. I mentioned Los Angeles and Cincinnati and Washington, D.C., Pittsburgh. There's now, they're in the first year in Seattle. There's one just gearing up in New Orleans, which is on everybody's list of probably the worst police department in the country. The basic things is a written policy on use of force. Now, New York City is a stop and frisk, but other cities, it's really been use of force. On when officers can use force and when they can't. And there is a report officers are required to fill out, and their sergeants are required to review that. And then at the next, you know, higher command level, lieutenants and captains review those. And there are requirements for meaningful discipline when officers systematically, you know, fail in that regard. I know it's hard for people to believe this because it's really is, there's a lot of paperwork involved, but in the chiefs, the former chiefs in Cincinnati, the former chief in Washington, the former chief in Pittsburgh, who were there under these consent decree experiences, have all stated, for the record, that their departments are better as a result of this.
And indeed, a number of them have done voluntary monitoring, which is interesting, too. So take that, Mr. Bloomberg.
Yes.
And much more. Yeah.
Well, one of the things also that I just want to parse out a bit more, generally what happens now at best, there's been a checkoff box where somebody says they really don't have to show any kind of reasonable cause for a stop, where they would check off a box. My favorite has always been the furtive look, which we know is what the rationalization for the killing of Amadou Diallo was in this city. Are those kind of specific remedies to look at those almost arbitrary and glib responses to somebody who's stopped and frisked, are those part of the recommendations that are taken into account here to rectify those practices?
That's going to change. Again, half of the stops and frisks and in the evidence in the case, the reason for the stop was furtive movement. Well, what is that? What exactly does that? And what is going to be in the court order? And what will be the new practice is the officers will have to provide a short narrative what furtive movement, and how does that relate to a crime? So the officers are going to have to explain, they're going to have to account for their actions in ways that they haven't beforehand, and it's going to be a major learning experience. We might say also that what came about in the companion case, Ligon, which was decided in January, it turned out the NYPD in police academy on stops and frisks was giving misinformation. They were not correctly training officers in the law of what is a lawful stop and frisk. So that's going to change too. There will be changes in the training and the training curriculum. Now, the advantage of having a monitor is that what I suspect the monitor will do is that the monitor will actually go to those training classes. That monitor will actually review the curriculum. And so there's going to be a check and balance here. It has not existed before in the NYPD.
You were talking about the experience in other cities that have reformed. Have you talked to any community leaders who had protested prior mispractices by police as to whether they're satisfied that things are going in the right direction?
Yes, I had a very interesting conversation a number of years ago. The very first federal pattern of practice investigation was Pittsburgh, 1997. And there was a consent decree for 5 years, and Pittsburgh was really a backward department, basic accountability procedures. And a couple of years after it was done, I talked with the ACLU attorney in Pittsburgh who brought the original case that again evolved into the federal investigation. I said, well, have things changed? And he said, yes, our phone doesn't ring as often. And what that meant was that they weren't getting as many complaints about excessive force and other abuses by Pittsburgh police officers. There was a change, and the change could have been measured by just counting the number of times the ACLU telephone rang.
This decision came, and it's interesting that you see the level of arrogance and you see the recalcitrance of the mayoral administration and the police head, Raymond Kelly, because within days of the decision, there was an announcement by the mayor that he wanted to see the implementation of fingerprinting of residents of public housing projects. The city is more backward than ever and is absolutely emphatic in its determination to appeal Judge Scheinlin's decision, but similarly to propagandize throughout our communities. And I do want you to comment on what the experience has been in other cities, that police officers will not only be in risk themselves, but our whole communities will fall to hell. There goes crime if police are inhibited or are disciplined in any way, and there is a halt to racial profiling. Our communities are in dire jeopardy. What's the reality?
The reality is quite different from that. Los Angeles, again, had a consent decree. It took a little bit longer than 5 years for them to finish it. There was a very thorough study done by Harvard University, very top people there. Following the consent decree and all of these new restrictions on officers and what they could do and all the new rules and everything, and guess what happened? Crime went down. Crime went down following the consent decree. Again, there was about a year or two time lag, you know, for them to take effect, and then crime really began to drop. So again, the mayor, police commissioner, the PBA are really being irresponsible in claiming there's going to be a crime wave. It hasn't happened. It didn't happen in Pittsburgh. The phrase that's used in the field is de-policing. You know, the cops are going to back off. They're afraid they're going to get sued. They're going to have people file complaints, and so they stop working, and therefore, you know, crime goes up. It doesn't happen. It was also studied in Pittsburgh, and there was no evidence that police officers were working less hard than they were beforehand. But they were working smarter. They were working better. They were working more legally than they were beforehand. And that is a total benefit to the people of New York City.
One of the procedures that Judge Scheinlin wanted to experiment with was body cameras on the police to see if that would help document the behavior. What has been the experience with that, and what's your feelings about that?
Well, this is something brand new. There are really just some experiments going on around the country. It hasn't been really tested over the long haul, but the preliminary evidence is that it's a benefit. First of all, from our standpoint, it's like video cameras in patrol cars, which many cities use. It provides a visual record of the incident, part of it. It doesn't capture everything. And so I think it appears to be working successfully in other cities. Should sort of step back here a second here and realize how much technology is really transforming the world of police accountability. We go back to 1991, the Rodney King incident. What really transformed that incident was that there was a guy across the street who recorded on his VHS. It's old-fashioned technology now. And that video went around the world. And there are just tens of millions of people in this country who really don't believe that the cops do these bad things. And when they could see it, it really changed, you know, public opinion. So body cameras are another way in which technology can provide, you know, a record of what happens in an encounter. And it's all to the good.
In 2011, I remember the statistic that the NYPD, you know, reported a record 685,000 stops, a 600% increase since Raymond Kelly really took over as NYPD commissioner in 2002. And of course, 84% of those stopped were black or Latino, and 88% of the people stopped were neither arrested nor received summonses. So this really debunks the whole mythology that is being put out by Raymond Kelly and by certainly the mayor. What would you say are a few of the other most salient recommendations that really evolved out of your testimony in this historic trial?
Again, it's a comprehensive approach to accountability, which begins at the ground level out there on the street. You know, what reports the officers have to make about each individual stop. It goes up to the training that they receive. There's going to be an audit process. Actually, there is an audit process. But the evidence in the trial showed that precincts failed year after year, and nothing was done about it. You know, really, one of the most interesting and I think important parts of the judge's opinion begins on page 60, and she goes on for 57 pages on, quote, the evidence of the deliberate indifference of the NYPD. I mean, it was really just staggering for me to see the testimony. This controversy was swirling around New York City for 14 years, and the top leaders didn't take it seriously. They didn't do anything.
And now we're beginning to see somewhat of a change with, of course, legislation that was in the city council about an IG, this decision of Judge Scheinlin, and indeed the whole aspect of mandatory minimums, which to some degree was at least in rhetoric, we'll see about action, addressed by Attorney General Holder. Sam, I want to make sure you're the author of, well, a mere 14 books on these very critical issues to our society. Tell us about the addition that's coming out in December.
It's the second edition of The New World of Police Accountability. What it is simply, to a great extent, it's an elaboration, an explanation of all the things that are in Judge Scheinlin's opinion about how to hold officers accountable and how to build an accountable police department. So that'll be out in December, The New World of Police Accountability, and it's just completely updated and it'll be out in December.
Well, we'll have you back around
right.
That time, and thank you for being the star witness, really, in this critical case with this wonderful decision of Judge Scheinlin. And we have been speaking with Samuel Walker, criminal justice expert, witness in the historic Floyd case that begins to put a damper on racial profiling and the whole practice, really, of stop and frisk. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
How long will it take to live in peace? I want to know. Can you tell me what have we learned from our history?
That's a good friend of mine, Sheila Gathwaite. One World, beautiful song, all the ones that she does. Now, in the wake of a grand jury's failure to indict killer cop Richard Haste, Constance Malcolm, the slain youth's mother, said, "I am more than outraged." Richard Haste broke into our home and killed my son in cold blood. The criminal justice system has failed us just as it failed the family of Trayvon Martin.
We demand an immediate federal investigation into my son's death. We will continue to fight without rest until we win justice.
We welcome, really, a freedom fighter and a strong, remarkable woman, Constance Malcolm, mother of Romali Graham.
Thanks for having me on.
It is entirely my pleasure. You know, I go to too many community rallies where young men have lost their lives at the hand of the New York City Police Department, and every time there's Constance Malcolm and Frank Graham, they have really become remarkable freedom fighters. And I have to say that Constance is also a 1199 member, too. So she's right up there on all fronts. Constance, I would just like to ask you, I don't know if you heard the news today, but there was this about stop and frisk that Judge Schindler has declared it unconstitutional. Any of your thoughts, because to me in many ways that absolutely implicates the death of your son?
Because that was the whole thing with my son. It was racial profiling and the stop and frisk policy. Yes, they passed, you know, their rule is unconstitutional, you know, to stop and frisk. But I'll be honest with you, I don't think it's ever going to stop. They're just going to find a different way of using it.
Well, you were outraged. I was outraged. The city was outraged. The grand jury, how could they not indict? So how do you kind of regroup from that outrage, and where do you go from here to try to bring some light to the killing and frankly, make Richard Haste accountable?
When the grand jury came back, no true bill. If you notice, I was not really crying because I already had lost faith in the system since May 15th when Stephen Barrett threw out that case, so they indicted the first indictment. So I didn't set myself up. I prepared myself because, you know, when we deal with the system, it don't work for us. And there you go. It shows that over and over. It doesn't work for us. Even when you're in your home where you are no threat to nobody, a cop could kick your door down and murder you, and nothing comes out of it.
I know this weekend you all marched, and it was a huge group of people that rallied to you, because you attract people, and Frank attracts people, and they rallied to the cause of Romali Graham, and they marched from way up in the Bronx, I mean way up towards Riverdale, all the way into Harlem. My goodness.
Yeah. And you know, but I look at it like, if it's for a cause, people going to do it because people are tired. They're tired of seeing young black and Latino men and women being murdered, and you see it over and over. And none of these cops have been held accountable for any of them. So people are going to do what they have to. And I was really proud of those people because we didn't know where we was really going. We were just walking because we were just frustrated, angry. And, you know, we were just walking. And the thing, we were supposed to stop on 135th. And I was like, you know, let's go to the state building. And everybody's like, all right. You know, and we went. And we regrouped there, and we had people speak out. You know, you had one woman was talking about how the cops came in our house and tried to beat up our husband, and the daughter jumped on top of the husband, said he wouldn't beat him after death. And you hear other people's story. You hear what these officers are doing to other family. It's so much that's going on that people really don't know about.
Yeah. Constance, the last time I saw you was Flatbush in Brooklyn, and that was
Kamani Gray,
yeah. Kamani Gray. And last night when I spoke to you, actually there was a woman over your house
Actually, she was not in my house. I went to her house.
And this was another mother who had experience. Tell us about it.
Actually, I just left the wake, too.
Yeah.
It's the young man that was shot by the a cop officer on, I'm not sure, but it's somewhere downtown in the South Bronx. He was 14. They claim he was shooting at another person.
Shaliver, yeah, 14.
Mm-hmm. And they shot him. And as a mother, I know what it is to lose a child. So I don't care what the surrounding of why he got killed. Our mother is still in pain, and I supported her on that.
Hmm. You know, Christine Quinn today was asked if she became mayor, would she keep Police Commissioner Kelly? She absolutely affirmed that she would. What are your thoughts about Police Commissioner Kelly?
This man, I think he just gave police officer the green light to this murder us people of, you know, of color. He doesn't care about us. All he cares about is, you know, he disrupts so many people's life, and he, you know, he knows it. When you start talking about schools and, you know, you're shutting down everything in our community. It's not happening in the rich folks, you know, community. It's in our community. And it seems don't matter to him. He don't care. And every time we lose every time something gets cut, it's in the black and Latino community, in the poor community.
Mm-hmm.
So how I feel about him, I really don't care about him.
Constance, one of the things that's happening now, there seems to be a green light on the federal government investigating the NYPD killing, indeed, of your son, Ramali.
Well, it's funny because we found about, you know, the no true bill of the indictment on Wednesday, and we had the rally on Thursday, and by the time I get home, I heard my cousin call me. She was like, did you hear? And I'm like, hear what? Because I was so frustrated. I didn't turn any TV on when I came home. And she was like, the Justice Department is going to look into your case. I'm like, oh, whatever. I don't think so. Maybe you're not hearing right. And then I called my lawyer. He was like, yeah, they say that. But, you know, while the case was going on, I could honestly say one day we was in court, and it was a lady was sitting in the front. And I remember the court officer went to her and asked if she was a reporter. And she said, no. He's like, well, you can't sit here. And he said to her, who are you? And she pulled out a badge. And she was an IG inspector. So right then and there, they was actually looking at the case. We just didn't know.
Thank you for your strength. We support you. We love you. And we, too, want justice for Ramali Graham.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.